We own this country.
We own it. And it's not you owning it and not politicians owning it. Politicians are employees of ours. And they're just going to come around and beg for votes every few years, and it's the same old deal. But I just think that it's important that you realize that whether you're Democrat or whether you're a Republican or whether you're Libertarian or whatever, when somebody does not do the job, we've got to let them go.
When your entire culture is under attack, you need the country's number one voice in defense of our American way of life. You need an ally in the fight against tyranny and corruption. You need your weekly dose of Lisa Payne Nager. Missouri Grassroots Radio Network proudly adds our own beauty to America the Beautiful, your own culture vigilante, Ms. Lisa Payne Nager.
If you can hear the sound of my voice, that means that Blog Talk Radio is not being hacked, and that's a good thing, because last week we were all set to go, and we couldn't go because there was a, something happened to Blog Talk. Somebody got into the network of Blog Talk Radio and shut it down, but we're here this week, and we're here with a great show lineup for you tonight, folks. We've got Dr. Dwayne Weed to talk to us about Oath Keepers. We've got a great interview. We had to postpone that from last week, and I'm sorry that you didn't get to hear it, but it's a fabulous interview. I was all set last week to give a rant about what folks need to do to get involved and engaged, and Dwayne Weed has a great outline for that kind of activity. Because as you will find from or hear from the rest of the show tonight, things are a big damn mess. And while we have all been wringing our hands and screaming and crying over the legislative and executive branches and the overreaches that have taken place over the last so many years, previous to the Obama administration as well, but certainly on steroids since Obama was elected, things have just gone crazy. My phone is ringing, sorry. Things have just absolutely gone crazy, and we were going to talk about, you know, what we need to do, folks, as a community to get things rolling again to where the people can take their government back. It's absolutely out of control, and people are not engaged. They're not informed because they're not engaged, and we need to change that. The Tea Party did a great job of rolling out in 2009, and we made some great strides. But then we allowed ourselves to be cajoled back into submission by the establishment Republican Party. You know, they please work with us. We'll take care of you, and they didn't take care of us, and they're selling us out, as we can see. So, we've been watching the legislative and executive branches do that. What we haven't been watching is the judicial branch. And you heard me say it here before on this show many, many times. Those other two branches of government are certainly doing a number on the country, but the judicial branch is what is really sawing the legs off of from underneath the stool. And nobody's watching it. And if you've been watching or listening to the Justina Pelletier story out of Boston over the last few weeks, it's been widely reported on The Blaze, but I don't know anybody else that's really reporting it. We're going to lay it out for you tonight. And we're here with Cindy McGee as well. Cindy has great information on this. She's been doing her homework on this issue. So thanks for being with me tonight, Cynthia. Cindy, I haven't
Thanks for having me. I'm glad to be back again. And, Fox News has covered it. Megyn Kelly has done a couple of interviews with Justina's father in the last week. So, but all of that is thanks to The Blaze picking it up. I know that a year ago there's a health magazine that's very good on, you know, just really taking care of yourself and stuff. I can give you the information, Lisa, you could post it. But they had a great article. They were really following this story a year ago. But mainstream media, crickets, and big surprise there. And this Justina Pelletier case is, folks, you know, if you're not paying attention and you're not willing to get involved, it's going to be your children or your grandchildren next. I'm just telling you straight up, I'm saying it out loud, none of us can afford to continue to bury our heads in the sand and not get involved. And Lisa is so right. We are not just being attacked from the legislative branch of our government. We are being attacked through the court system and through our justice system. And what is happening to families through that system is just mind-blowing. And this has been going on for a long time. The Justina Pelletier case is not unique, but I'm glad that it is getting the national focus, or starting to get the focus that it's getting and the attention that it's getting, because people need to wake up and realize that this is an abuse of power that is staggering, and it has to be stopped. And have to get involved to make it stop.
You know, and if we come away with nothing else from listening to this show tonight, what I want you to come away with is that this situation, this Justina Pelletier situation, is not unique, and it is not removed from you sitting at your computer listening to this show. This could happen to you, because not only do we have this situation happening in Boston, we're going to talk to Paul Ellison in a little while from Missouri. He has followed a similar case in Missouri, where the courts have completely put a stranglehold on parents, and the school district has moved in on this issue as well to go against court orders to take away parental rights here in Missouri. And I can tell you from personal experience, folks, I mean, I was in the court system for a while too. It's kind of what catapulted me back into the political genre. I never really wanted to be here, but I keep kind of getting pulled back into politics because of these situations that I've been thrown in. But I'm telling you, I know from personal experience that the judicial system, not only here in Missouri, but certainly in Missouri too, just takes incredible liberties far, far afield from the state constitution and the federal constitution, and nobody's watching them. It's all a big secret. They're doing it in the dark. They, and they're getting away with it. And they've created this huge bureaucratic, institution industry. It's an industry now, because there's so much money involved, and you have absolutely no recourse to fight it. And I'm telling you, these two cases that we're going to hear tonight are just astounding. They're appalling. But I've talked to dozens and dozens of people over the last few years who have very similar cases. You would not believe the extent to which the government is reaching into the private lives of people and taking their kids away, and under what conditions, and what conditions they're putting their kids in. It's amazing. So we're going to talk about all those things. But let's get back to the Justina Pelletier case. So, Cindy, you've really done your homework on this. So I wanted to kind of, for folks that are just listening in for the first time who do not know what this case is about, why don't you kind of give us an outline of how this all started?
Well, basically what happened is a year ago, the Pelletier family took their daughter, Justina, to a hospital on the recommendation of the physicians that were already treating her. She had contracted the flu, and she was being treated by these physicians. One of the doctors who had been treating her had actually moved to Boston Children's Hospital. And so they transferred her to – she went there for the flu, because the mitochondrial disease that she has really causes her a lot of problems. Well, when she got there, another doctor, an ER doctor, intervened and took the case, did not call her doctor in, and this doctor decided that she was not suffering from the mitochondrial disease that she'd been treated for several years, that she was instead suffering from somatoform, which is the new term for Munchausen's by proxy. And the parents, I don't think they fully understood at the time exactly what that diagnosis meant, but the parents, the doctor said, why don't we try treating her and try some things? And, and the family was open to seeing if something else would work to help their daughter with the issues that she was having. About 3 days into it, they wanted her doctor to come back, and they disagreed with the treatment regimen that this doctor was recommending as they began to understand what he was doing. And they asked to have her physician brought back in, and they wanted her treated by him, and they disagreed with the diagnosis. Well, that started the ball rolling. The hospital called in the Department of Child Services in Boston, and they took custody of their daughter, And she has been trapped in that hospital for the past year, and the parents now are only allowed one day a week that they can visit her for an hour supervised. In the meantime, the doctors quit treating her for the disease that she had, stopped giving her, took her off the medications that she was on. When she went into the hospital, 6 weeks before she went into the hospital, Justina was actually figure skating in competition. She's now in a wheelchair and just going downhill steadily. And the Pelletier family has been fighting in the courts to get their daughter back for the past year. And the court system has stood in their way. They've continued to side with the Department of Family Services and the hospital. And, you know, so this week they finally went back to court. And again, the case has started to gain national attention. And the father, the courts put a gag order on the Pelletier family, saying that the judge said that they were not allowed to talk to any of the media or anything. This was a little over a year ago. It wasn't quite a year ago. I think it was around May, April or May that the gag order went into effect. Well, they've abided by everything that they've been asked to do, the Pelletier family has. But they've watched their daughter. She's dying. And the father finally decided, Lou Pelletier said, I'm not staying silent anymore, and he started approaching the media and doing interviews, and it was picked up by the Blaze, and they got involved, and they checked it out. And, you know, when you hear this, you're thinking, oh, there's got to be something else going on there. The hospital and the courts wouldn't just do that, now would they? But, yes, they would, and they have. And so
because it's been checked
they
out.
Eventually,
I think you need to punctuate that point because, I mean, people are skeptical, and that's what I've always run into as well. When I was telling my story, when I was going through my story, and when I've talked to other people, I mean, you always, and I've run into some kooks who have been not giving me the full deal, and some of them are not up front. But most of the people that I've talked to are completely up front. They're not crazy. They're not drug addicts. They're not, they're not out of step with what normal culture is in any way. I think this is the truth of the Pelletiers.
Yes, and the thing is that we have to stop we have been cajoled in this country into this mindset that government and these agencies all know better, and after all, they're there to protect the children, they're there to prevent abuse, and we want abuse to stop, and we have literally turned the reins of parenting and our rights over to a system that is, come on, folks, the bottom line is these people aren't elected. They don't represent you. They are bureaucracies that have been created by other arms of our government, and they operate independent of any oversight. They have no accountability. They just do what they want to do. And this is one of those cases. And in addition, it's now come to light that at the same time that Justina Pelletier was kidnapped by the hospital, which is really what happened, there were five other children in that hospital that the exact same thing happened to them. The doctors decided that the diagnosis of other physicians was incorrect, and they diagnosed those children with this somatoform disease. Now, something. Another interesting thing that's come to light is that is a specialty of Boston Children's Hospital, somatoform disorder. That's something that hospital specializes in. It's a teaching hospital. And another interesting fact is that in the admission forms for Boston Children's Hospital, children who are admitted there, if for some reason that it states in the admission forms that if the state gets custody of those children, then the hospital can then use use those children in experimental medical programs. And so, and that begs the question. We're taking these really, the hospital is taking these children away, saying that they're being abused, and then the hospital has free reign to abuse these children through their medical experiments. Now,
exactly.
Who's really taking care of these kids? Who's really looking out for them? Obviously not the courts. They've continued to side with DFS and the hospital with absolutely no evidence that this family has in any way, shape, or form harmed their child. And if Justina was suffering from somatoform, the 13, 14 months now that she's been without contact with her family, You would think she would be getting better. Instead, her physical health has dramatically declined.
Right.
So,
And the somatoform, the name, the other name that everybody knows it by is Munchausen's by proxy.
Right, which means that basically the parents are being accused of making their daughter sick and seeking medical treatment that she didn't need to gain attention for themselves. That's what Munchausen's by proxy kind of is. And it does end up making kids sick, but that is not what is wrong with this child. And there's ample medical evidence to substantiate that. And another interesting fact is that, you know, again, the system is abusing this family. The courts are just acting, I don't even have a word for it, Lisa.
They're just way beyond the pale. I mean, they've just totally, it's like Nazi.
What the courts are doing is criminal.
Exactly.
And this family has another daughter who has the same problem, has been diagnosed with it. She's still with the family. Nobody's taken her away.
Because they had the good sense not to take her to Boston Hospital.
Exactly. Thank you very much. So I guess one of the takeaways from this for people is that I want you to understand is that you're just one ER visit with your children, potentially away from having your children taken away. This isn't just happening in Boston. It's happening all across the country. This happens to be now a high-profile case, which hopefully will shed some light, and I really hope some heads roll and some doors get blown open that have needed to be blown open for a long time to expose the corruption in this system that is not really there to help children, but it is tearing families apart and abusing the children in the process.
You know, I just kind of want to bring up one point. There are strategies that these folks use to just kind of, you know, pull the legs out from underneath you. One strategy, and I've seen this, so this is not an unusual strategy. Actually, when I heard about this, I just kind of rolled my eyes because I know that this goes on constantly. But think about this, and it's just been one issue that's been reported in the whole Justina case. But when we are at a crucial time in our country's history where our freedom of speech is being so eroded, they issued a gag order on these parents. When these parents finally got fed up and went to the media or were getting ready to go to the media, the judge, who's supposed to be looking out for the best interests of the child, in order to have a cloak of darkness remain over this case so nobody could watch what they were doing, they issued a gag order on the dad so that he could not go out and tell his story to get help because they were taking his child away. Now, if that doesn't tell you exactly what the problem is with this, that there is a problem, that this isn't a huge red flag that should be flying up in the air, why would a judge need to issue a gag order in this case whatsoever? And I can tell you that this is not the first time that this has happened. I have seen this before, and I have had experiences with this before where gag orders have been issued to keep parents quiet.
Absolutely. And something that needs to be understood, too, is you know, this gag order was never put in written form by the judge. It was verbal from the bench. And Lou Pelletier, after coming out and speaking to the media and telling the story of what's happening to his daughter and asking people to help him get his daughter freed, one of the things that he's now going to be held in contempt of court or I forget exactly what the charge is, but he has, you know, they're trying to make that stick. And fortunately, there is an attorney from the Liberty Council who has, now that he's heard about the case, they've gotten involved to help protect, help get Justina freed and to also protect the family from these charges that involve the
right
gag order. And so, you know, it's outrageous. And, you know, another thing, too, in our society, you know, when we hear that a parent, children have been taken away from a parent, we've allowed ourselves to develop a mentality where we just believe the state is right and the parent is guilty.
Mm-hmm.
And we need to return to the idea in our laws that state and our Constitution that we are innocent until proven guilty. And the Palantirs
right.
have been proven guilty of nothing. Even
mm-hmm.
though the courts are still keeping this child away from her parents, they've not been convicted of anything. Nothing.
Yep. They're, you know what? And when these charges are alleged by the state, there's no
mm-hmm.
time frame in which they have to prove
nope.
the substance of their charges. So they can drag these things on for God knows how long, forever if they want to. They're not given any criteria under which they have to live by, to work by, no rules to follow whatsoever. They can just keep this thing going forever. And when you're dealing with children, I mean, I've seen this in other cases as well, where they'll take kids away from their parents. I know parents who have lost, they've taken their kids away from their parents. They haven't seen their kids in years. So they could take
mm-hmm.
their kids away when they're 8 years old, and 5 years can go by while you fight this. And, of course,
right.
you also lose all your personal wealth while you fight this, trying to get your child back. And they know that you'll spend every dime that you have to fight for your children. So they just allow this to go. And the judges have the power. The people sitting on the bench have the power to moderate the reasonableness with which these cases are dealt with. And they allow these cases to drag on. They don't police the
right.
attorneys fighting the case. They just continue to allow these things to go on. And most states have a best interest of the child standard, which is very vague, by the way. If you try
mm-hmm.
to find out what the best interest of the child standard is, it's very, very vague. And it never seems to be the driving criteria for what most people feel is the best interest of the child, and you don't understand that until you actually get drug into the system. Most people sitting out
yep.
there think that the judge is going to act fairly, he's going to make people stay in line and not go off the rails, that they're not going to drag these things out, that they are going to put the children's interest first, and folks, it is not happening. And actually, we have a caller, Thomas, on the line with a story that he would like to tell. Actually, one of the funny things that I want to talk about before we put Thomas on the line is that the more you talk about these things, this
mm-hmm.
this judicial issue where parental rights are just being totally taken away on a daily basis, the more people start to come out of the woodwork. I mean, I used to talk about this years ago too, and you just would be surprised by the number of people that contacted me while I was dealing with this issue as well. They've come out of the woodwork, and you know, I think there are a lot of people floating around out there in the atmosphere who really have no direction. They don't think there's anywhere to go to tell their story, but there are so many people out there who've been touched by this issue. Thomas, thank you for calling into the program tonight. You said you had a story.
I do. How are you, Lisa?
Very well. Thanks for calling in.
Not a problem. Well, I was born in 1974 at the Kent City Osteopathic Hospital in right off of Independence Avenue in Kent City, Missouri. And originally they had told my mom she needed to abort me because I was a tubal pregnancy, which I am a tubal pregnancy survivor.
Oh my.
And long story short, she said no. And in the midst of that, instead of giving her performing the C-section to take me, my mom became one of only two women to ever give birth naturally to a tubal pregnancy.
Wow.
And the other thing with that is that when I was 6 months old, well, they approached my mom, because I was in the hospital after that for like 4 months of my first 5 months of life. And around the time I was 6 months old, and this is what my mom had shared with me, which stunned me, she was approached and told by the hospital that there was something going on with my hormones and stuff like that, and that they needed to perform surgery on me. And she said no. I was taken away by the state of Missouri put in foster care where the procedure was performed. Now, let me tell you what that procedure was. I was surgically sterilized at 6 months of age.
Oh, my gosh. At
oh
how
God.
Old?
Six months.
Who decided that?
The state of Missouri.
But you were still under the custody of your mom, right, Thomas?
No, they took they took me out of her custody, put me in foster care where the procedure was performed. She had said no.
What were the grounds for them to take you away from your mother?
Well, because I was really, really sick, my mom was taking me to the hospital because I was sick, really sick. And here's something else of note, because I heard your guest talk about Boston Children's Hospital was has a experimentation clause in it, mm-hmm. in their application fees. Well, the Kansas City Osteopathic Hospital was a hospital that dealt with healing through bone manipulation, that sort of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I didn't walk until I was almost 2 years old. When I got transferred to Children's Mercy Hospital, they actually thought I was mentally retarded because I could not move any of my joints. And I'm sure both of you being mothers, you all remember how babies are wiggly and they move and just very
mm-hmm.
flexible.
Right.
That was not me. And so in talking to my mom, I was in a hospital for a week after that. And she suspects that they experimented on me. They did something to me because just this past year, last year, I actually called that hospital up and asked them for my medical records. And they said to me, well, the state of Missouri said that we could destroy all records after a certain amount of time. What she didn't know is that I knew that you can destroy the paper records, but you have to have a written copy of the medical record for just in case something happened to me later on down the line. But
mm-hmm.
I didn't even try to argue that with them. I actually contacted the state of Missouri to get copies of my adoption records, which also contained my entire medical history. And when I went in and applied for it and I filled out the information, they sent it in, and I never heard anything back from them. Well, when I called them up and said, hey, I filled out an application to get copies of my medical records and my adoption records, because I later on was adopted, they told me, you need a court order. And here's what's interesting. I was not told at the office in Kansas City, at the state office building in downtown Kansas City, they did not tell me that I needed a court order for my medical record. I was not told that until about 3 or 4 months later, after waiting for my record, when I contacted mm-hmm. them. So what that says to me, unless you have something to hide, there was no reason for my court records to be sealed, not to the owner, not when I'm almost 40 years old. So,
and you were born in 1974, did you say, Thomas?
Yes, I was born in 1974.
So, this is not new news. It's been going on for a while. Same
yes,
kind of thing. Hospitals and the state taking liberties with your parental decisions. We have evidently documented evidence right here in Missouri as far back as 1974 and probably longer than that. Amazing.
Oh, yeah, it goes back longer than that. In fact, the hospital I was born in was also one of the hospitals that, after Roe v. Wade was passed in 1973, they were one of the hospitals that were performing the abortions. In fact, when I looked up the pictures, they actually had a picture in their archives of the rooms where they performed the original abortion. It was a metal table, and underneath the metal table, under the shelf underneath, they had a metal wash pan. And I'm looking at that like, wow.
Mm.
And so, you know, it's like we have to, I don't know if it's too late or what, but the thing of it is that this has slowly been happening for, it's been going back
for
decades. You've had the progressives planning this. You've had them planning this, the foster care system. I don't know. You know, my goodness, Lisa, this is a very, very passionate subject for me because I was in the foster care system my entire life. I am a product of a failed adoption, not successful. It failed. I had to actually run away from my adoptive home because the state of Kansas would not intervene, or at least, let me put it like this. My social worker, I'm a black man. My social worker was white, but it was actually the black social worker that the SRS office sent in who was calling me a liar. Even when I showed him the bloody clothes from where she had hit me on my shoulder with a 2x4.
Oh my God.
And I showed it to him. He said, "You just lied." And so what it was, my social worker, believe me, but it was the black social worker who they sent in that was calling me a liar. I finally had to just run away. I actually ran away from that home, and it is by the grace of God that I am still alive today. I didn't end up in the gang, jail, all that stuff, because I really didn't like people enough. But I'm telling you what has happened, and it does go down to politics, and that's what really hurts me, because you have the federal government that pays these state agencies a certain amount. In some states, it's $20,000 per kid. I don't know what it is in Missouri, but it is an astronomical amount. And the reason why it got where it was because we as conservatives and stuff, liberty-minded people, we actually buried our heads in the sand. That's what happened. Because these progressives from the 1960s, you know, the Woodstock era, all those folks, they're now the ones in office. And what I'm telling you, we can take it back. But what it's going to take, Lisa, and you know me, it's going to take unity. And this is a social issue, but it's also a fiscal issue. And what we have to understand, those two things are not separate. They are not separate, because if you look at the liberals and the things that they're pushing, the agenda on same-sex marriage is social. They are the ones who are now always bringing up the abortion issue. That's social. But because of the fact that it has now came out that we taxpayers, us as taxpayers, are paying $542 million a year to Planned Parenthood? Excuse me? That is a fiscal issue.
Yes, you're right. It does bleed over.
We need to unify. That's what it boils down to, because we can defeat them. We have the right message, but it's like with what you and your guest are talking about, that's what it's going to take, not just getting awareness, but we're going to have to come up with solutions to defeat them, because they think they're above the law, but they have to realize one thing. They work for us. We don't work for them. So,
yeah, that's yeah absolutely. Problem. Thank you, Thomas, for sharing your story with us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you for taking my call, Lisa.
Okay. Yeah, that's amazing. I mean, you know, and I think when I was posting the link for the show tonight, around Facebook and around the internet, people are starting to pop up. I mean, I think that this kind of thing is hitting people all over the place, and they just have absolutely no idea where to go to tell their story. I mean, the judicial system, I mean, they hold all power. You know, if a judge decides to send you to jail, or they have the power to take your kids away, or they have the power to do just about anything, it scares the living daylights out of folks. They don't know how to fight it, and it's a complicated issue. You can't fight it without an attorney, and most attorneys are not interested in fighting the system. You know, they're not going to go up against a judge. They know how these judges want to rule, and they've got to go against that judge tomorrow with another case, and they don't want to tick them off. It's a sad, sad situation, folks. It's a big deal.
Don't you think, too, Lisa, it's that we've been programmed in this country that if we just do the right thing and we just cooperate with the authorities,
yeah, if you're reasonable,
the right thing, I haven't done anything wrong. So this is really bad. They shouldn't be doing this. But they're going to give my child back to me. They're not going to just keep my child. I haven't done anything wrong. And
sure, because we're all talking about the best interest
in
of the kids.
The parents are staying silent in the hope that the courts are going to do the right thing and just give their children back. And too often, that is not what happens.
Absolutely. That's just scary. Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and we're going to come back with Paul Ellison. We're going to talk about another similar case happening here in Missouri, government overreach, judicial overreach, dealing with just parental rights. We'll take a quick break, and we'll be right back.
It really is time for the people of America to take up pitchforks.
Have you joined Missouri Grassroots Coalition yet? The results of the 2012 election proved that the grassroots conservatives need to work harder to make their voices heard in government. The best way for Missouri conservatives to make their voices heard is to join together within the Missouri Grassroots Coalition Network and show our elected that we are a strong, unified, conservative voice in Missouri. Go to the website, MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, and click on the Join tab. Give us your contact information so that we can keep you updated on the latest developments in Jefferson City and beyond. Also, sign up for GrassFire Alerts so that you can get immediate notifications when we need to call grassroots conservatives together in action. Use the MGC network to help your grassroots organization speak with a louder voice combined with grassroots groups across the state. Together, we can strengthen the conservative voice in Missouri.
I've got a feeling that the tide is turning.
Is life so dear, or peace so sweet, as to be purchased at the price of chains and slavery? Forbid it, Almighty God! I know not what course others may take, but as for me, give me liberty, or give me death.
We're back. This is Lisa Payne-Nager, and you're listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio. I am here with Cindy McGee. We just heard from Thomas about his story, amazing story about how his life was affected by government overreach and his situation with social workers and hospitals. And in a minute, we're going to talk to Paul Ellison of American Spring. But before we go back to the topic, Patrick Warner of Americans for Prosperity contacted me just before we went on the show and wanted me to let you know, folks, that tomorrow morning, the CAP Spending Bill, SJR 26, will be heard in the Senate Ways and Means Committee and is scheduled to be up for a vote. And they need you to contact Senator Wayne Wallingford at 573-751-2459 and tell him you want him to support this SJR 26. The cap spending measure is a modest spending cap that limits the government spending in Missouri. If passed, it would need to be approved by voters of Missouri and would limit state general revenue appropriations to the amount of appropriations made in the previous fiscal year increased by an inflationary growth factor. As Missouri returns to budget surpluses after several years of high unemployment, and God is it high, and stagnant economic growth, our elected leaders may be tempted to return to the days of spending those budget surpluses, and that's the truth. So, We need you to contact Senator Mike Parson at 573-751-8793 and Senator Wayne Wallingford, and I need to learn how to speak, at 573-751-2459 and urge them to support SJR 26. Okay, now back to the topic. Okay, a few months ago, I started getting these Facebook posts on my personal Facebook page, and I had kind of read them, and I get a lot of contact from people. I get them on my Facebook, I get them on my LinkedIn page, I get them all over the place. People find my email about these issues that it's overwhelming. I mean, I hear stories all the time about the government overreach and how the courts are constantly chopping away at parental rights and taking your decision-making processes away about how you take care of your kids. And I recently got another update. There's a case brewing here in Missouri about a family and the court's overreach and how the schools are also interfering in the processes of dealing with parental rights and parenting plans and things. And Paul Ellison of American Spring has been reporting on this for quite some time. He's got all the details on this story. It's a very complicated and intricate story. You know, you've got a good parent and a bad parent. You've got alleged abuse and all of these things kind of going on. It's very intricate. But the reality is you've got the government entities just diving into this from every angle and taking away, to actually eliminating anything that has to do with the best interest of the children involved here. And looking at this story, and I'll let Paul explain it in a minute, but it's almost like a feeding frenzy from the bureaucracy and the institutions that have made this situation almost an industry, a money-making industry, feeding off of this family, and it's just amazing to see how these poor kids are getting just cast away in all of the situation here. Thanks for being on with me tonight, Paul.
Well, thank you, Lisa. I appreciate the time to sit down and talk with you and Cindy. It's a pleasure to be here.
And I didn't realize when we first started talking that you're the Guerrilla Radio American Spring guy.
That's
you have
me.
Your own blog talk
you
show. When do you
I
got,
do,
when
as
you
a matter
air?
Of fact. Guilty. I'm on every day, Monday through Friday. Monday and Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, I'm on at noon until 2. And on Tuesday evenings at 8 o'clock until 10.
Okay. So, Paul, I mean, this is a very complicated story. You can't give us all the details, but can you give us a synopsis of what's happening here from the beginning?
Well, sure. And, you know, I guess I'll start with this. It's a strange place to be talking about these issues, first of all, for me. I heard Thomas's story earlier, and, you know, topics of forced sterilization of these entities that are preying on children, you know, these are the nightmares that you keep in the closet, the things that, as you said earlier, you want to believe the state has the children's best interest in mind.
And most
unfortunately,
people do believe that.
Sure. I think, you know, I'm certainly guilty of that. I would like to think that I'm, you know, an average person when it comes to, having a peripheral awareness of things like Department of Family Services, et cetera, but no real, you know, dealings with any entity like that. So you assume that they always have the kid's best interest in mind, and unfortunately that's just not the case. To be here standing and talking about this kind of thing is something that I never intended to do. You mentioned my radio show. I started kind of doing some work in this area, meaning kind of political talk show work, back in 2011. And as we kind of move forward, I started guilty as charged. I suppose I'm one of those dirty, nasty liberal folks because I felt like my viewpoints were better represented by the Occupy movement than anything else. And I know that may sound kind of off-putting in the beginning, but hang on with me. I'm not crazy, I promise. But as we kind of went through this reporting, it was a matter of time before all your attention goes from national issues back down to local issues. And in looking at local politics at the Lake of the Ozarks, This was my first real experience in looking at a political landscape and having no choice but to come away, shake my head and say, what in the world is going on here? We have a really nasty political scene. And with that in mind, the school board elections in the Camdenton School District last year were quite contentious, and it brought a number of people together from all sides. And this was kind of the beginning of a Common Core coming together around those issues regarding our schools. And so I've had an opportunity to work with people across the aisle, and as a result of this, as you said earlier, you get contacted a lot from people who have information that they want to share once they understand that you're willing to vet that information and then put it out into the public. That was certainly the case here. I was contacted by Sherry Lagares, who is the grandparent, a grandmother of Kyle and Nicole. And she reached out to me in talking about the school-related issues associated with Common Core because of her previous experience as a parent in the Camdenton School District with her son, Denny. And she actually, Denny is the father of Kyle and Nicole, and she had filed a lawsuit against the school regarding and against the special ed department and how they were wanting to provide an education for Denny, who was dyslexic. She took her case to the Supreme
Court. Oops, I think we lost him.
Uh-oh.
Oh, he just, yeah, we just lost him. He'll call back.
He'll call back.
Yeah. So, you know what, another thing that I kind of want to put out here, and I've talked, when I talked to Paul on the phone about this, is something I think that courts have done, this is just a huge movement, I think, to undermine the family structure. Because I think if you undermine the family structure in America, you can topple it. And I think they're doing it via the courts. I think they started doing it when they initiated no-fault divorce. And I think what they've done in this case is I think that when they attack families in this way, it becomes a mom, you know, especially in issues of custody, it's the mom against the dad or the dad against the mom, and they have to vilify one or the other to make their, you know, to give justification for the rulings that they give. So we'll talk to Paul a little bit about that when he's back on. Let's put him back on the air.
Sorry about that, ladies.
Hey, Paul. Go ahead and finish. We want to hear about this story.
Sure. I'm sorry. I'm not entirely sure. I think that I had said that Sherry won her case in the Missouri Supreme Court against the Camdenton School District, and this was true. What happened after that or in the wake of that through the Camdenton School District does directly affect the case we're talking about now with her grandchildren. After the school district, Camdenton School District, was beaten in this case, another lawsuit was filed against Sherry Lagares' sister regarding her children who were at that time being homeschooled. It was filed through Child Find, and the person responsible for filing that or for participating in that was Dr. Tammy Lapardis, who was at that time the director of special education in Camdenton and is currently the director of special programs in the Lebanon School District, where the Lagares children, Kyle and Nicole, are currently attending school. From the outset, this is problematic. But what we have found out is in looking at this case and in looking just simply from the school aspect, what brought it to my attention from Sherry, she said, look, my son was, charges of educational neglect were filed against him almost immediately, and it didn't happen just once, it happened twice. It happened first in the Camdenton School District when his son Kyle was younger in 2010. A phone call actually came from the school district to say that he was responsible for educationally neglecting Kyle. And this was then repeated in 2012 in the Lebanon School District by Dr. Tammy Lapardis. Some of the ties in this case, some of the important ties, for example, I mentioned the lawsuit earlier that was filed through Camdenton against Sherry Laguerre's sister in what seems to be a move of retribution. It was filed against her nieces or her children, and she was unable to that was filed through the law firm of Mikus Goldman and O'Toole, who represents over 300 school districts in our state, including mm-hmm. the Lebanon School District. And mm-hmm. through the school, at a meeting after the children had been in school for less than a month, Tammy Lapardis, and we have audio of this, and I've played it on our show, Tammy Lapardis handed Denny Lagares a calendar with a brand new custody agreement that did not in any way, shape, or form reflect a recently signed divorce decree.
From the school.
Exactly.
What the heck?
Her response to this, and it's on audio, when they clearly point out that you have a copy of this custody agreement, and this doesn't match up to it at all, the response to this change in custody from Tammy Lapardis was, if you, and I quote, if you don't like it, sue us.
So where do they get off defying a judge's order for a custody agreement? And what was their motivation for that?
Well, the motivation is you can look at it from a lot of different ways. As you said earlier, this case has a lot of different levels to it, levels of involvement from the judges serving in the 26th Circuit to the sheriff's office to other government entities, Department of Family Services, certainly. This is a case where they have literally sought to rewrite law. And I'm talking specifically now about the interpretations made by the school lawyers and the power that they have assumed over our own daily lives, apparently, mm-hmm. Because they're making a determination that they can change this based on the authority they have as guardians of our children. There can be no other, it's just an assumption and a twisted legal interpretation as opposed to having any real basis in logical or legal grounds.
It's the assumption that the state has more authority over your child than you do.
Absolutely it is. And, you know, as I mentioned earlier that Common Core has been something that kind of drew our community together. Mm-hmm. Stacy Shore is a good friend of mine and has been active with that movement throughout the state. And Gretchen and Ann, of course, from
right.
Missouri Education Watchdogs. And, I kind of began working on this story, I reached out to those ladies because this is initially where this story started, was through the school district from the investigation point. And, for me, it was representative of the very worst aspects of Common Core. If you have a system designed to fail, more and more kids are going to be put in this or left open to special ed. And if this is how special ed is handled throughout our state, and it's codified by a lawyer and a law firm who represents 300 districts, well, then what does that mean for our future, for our kids?
Absolutely. All that lovely data collection all just tied up in a nice, tidy little bow.
Well, and what's really funny about that you mentioned that is I have another piece of audio that I'm going to be releasing this week that goes directly to that itself, data collection, and what they're doing with it and who they're sharing it with. It's quite obvious in this case that that's going on already on a scale that it should really make all parents kind of scratch their heads and wonder what the heck's going on here.
So where do we stand with this family? What's going on with them and their kids now? Where are their kids? What's the latest standing with them in the courts?
Well, currently, as it sits now, a federal lawsuit has been filed by the Legarez family. And it's an incredibly interesting federal lawsuit that's been filed, and it isn't without precedent. Whenever we were looking into all of the different aspects associated with this case with the Legarez kids and looking at the different government entities involved, while we were doing our research, we came across a case that bears almost parallel. It's uncanny how similar these two cases are. It was a case in Benton County that involved a father and his son, and it is just almost identical to a T. He also filed a federal lawsuit against the entities that were involved in his case, and it was filed under an argument that is called color of law. And essentially, what that means, it's in the U.S. code, but basically what that means is that if you use government office or influence, or if agents of government uses or abuses their office in such a way as to perform all of this different list of grievances or transgressions, then they can be held, you know, responsible for that criminally. And in this case, one of the most interesting things is that you have the last portion of the color of law entry in the U.S. Code talks about the most serious of crimes. It talks about kidnapping. It talks about attempted kidnapping. It talks about sexual abuse. And it says that those people found guilty under color of law could be punishable by a fine of whatever the amount of money is and up to death. This is what the Legarez's have done as a last-ditch effort to try to intervene on behalf of their children in order to protect them. They have filed this federal color of law lawsuit in which there is literally a name of a list of defendants that is a who's who in certainly local politics, and it ranges from school entities. Yeah, it really is, and it has to be, because whether we like it or not, you know, we're supposed to have built-in oversight for these agencies that continue to overreach and overstep their bounds. And when that oversight breaks down, we have no choice but to hold those people responsible for allowing it to happen on their watch.
Amazing. So the Legarez's have not lost custody of their kids. Is that correct?
Actually, at this point, the father has had his parental rights taken from him. He has had them taken from him and only currently gets to visit the children 1 hour, I believe it is, a week, under supervision at the Department of Family Services Center in Laclede County.
And the parents are divorced.
This is Cindy.
Yes.
I read all of the information on your website about this case today, and it's horrifying. Now, one thing that I think, and perhaps you were getting there, but in reading through everything, not only has the father lost custody of his children, but the custody now goes to the mother, who is abusing those children and has been from the get-go, which didn't that precipitate some of what happened when the father took the son to the doctor and found
Absolutely.
That he was being abused. And that was what precipitated everything when the father intervened on behalf of his children to try to show abuse and to stop it. Then everything just went south from there. Am I correct in that?
That's absolutely right. They, in 2010, the parents split for good in October of that year. And what had happened was Kyle had a severe injury to his leg. The father, Dennis, had seen enough signs of neglect previous to this. Horrible incidents. There was a dog stomping incident that occurred in the home when the children were very young and they were married, where the mother stomped to death a family pet and left the animal in the living room with the children. They have been and were, as previous to 2010 and the separation, when in their mother's custody, the children were in just absolutely horrid conditions. And what I mean by that is they were, as toddlers, doors were put up and stacked up to barricade them in their rooms so that their mother could sleep all day because of her internet activity, or her activities on the internet kept her up all night. So the children were using their closets as toilets, essentially. I mean, it just all kinds of things. And yes, you're right. In 2010, the split, whenever that came about, Kyle had a severe injury to his leg, and a doctor had indicated that the leg had been broken previously and that it was an old wound and had healed over and was creating the issue. And at that point, of course, Denny Lagares knew that there was absolutely no reconciling the situation, and they split.
Wow. I don't even know where to go from here. So where are the children? They're with the mother?
The children currently are with the mother and the live-in boyfriend. They have supervised Department of Family Service visits. The person or the agent in charge of that case, Ms. Killian, has been less than professional, I would say, or less than, I've got to say, I've listened to some of the, and I'm saying this because I've listened to some of the audio tapes. Denny, because of his dyslexia, and this is one of those things, you know, I guess doing what we do, you kind of wait for that case or that story where somebody comes in and you feel like Glenn Greenwald just met Edward Snowden. The reason I say that, and this is a lesson to all the parents out there listening, because of Denny's dyslexia, he has always tried to audio record everything he does so that he can go back and refer to it later. In this case, it's tremendous because he has all of this documentation of all these different things. And when you hear some of the things in these Department of Family Service visits that are said knowing positively that there's a Department of Family Service worker at the very least sitting on the other side of the mirrored glass, and you hear what these children are saying, things like, well, dad asks, well, how did you hurt yourself? And the child says, I can't tell you that, Dad. I'm not supposed to tell you anything about that. If you hear that as a Department of Family Service agent, shouldn't that get you out of your chair into the room and find out what exactly is going on with those kids? And yet, repeatedly, this is not only ignored, it is repeatedly reflected that the father himself is the problem, and that he's putting these ideas in these children's heads. It's despicable is really the best word I can think of for that particular agency's actions in this case.
I was listening to some of the audio that you have on your website today of the meetings that were held, and if you don't believe that this kind of thing can be going on in America, if you don't believe that government agencies are overstepping their boundaries and treating people with such disrespect and just unilaterally taking away their parental rights, you need to listen to how these people are talking to the defendants. In this case, it was Denny, right? It was just amazing, the condescension and just the total overstep. I mean, they're making up things as they go along. Denny was obviously tape recording a session with I think it was someone from the school at one point.
It was Tammy Lapardis, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, and she's telling him that it is illegal to tape record the conversation. It's not illegal to do that in Missouri. You can tape record a conversation or a meeting or whatever. And where was she coming up that it was illegal to be able to tape that conversation? And telling
you know,
him that he was breaking the law, lying to him.
What's funny about that is, I'm not saying funny to be flip, but, you know, I've gotten involved with school activities and school board issues much more than before. We've seen this kind of assumption of power through the administration of certainly our school district for a while, and it's all designed to try to take away your voice as a parent, to redefine what your role as a parent is. Absolutely, and you're right. The way that woman spoke to that family in that meeting was, first of all, how would you like to be the parent sitting on the other end of that? How would you feel? I mean,
you know, he was very composed. I was very impressed with the way he could maintain his composure, because I think if somebody was speaking to me in that tone and taking those liberties with the law and the already pre-decided documents from the court and just turning it upside down, who the hell does she think she is? And right. For him to maintain his composure was quite amazing. I was very impressed by that. It was just, astounded by what I was hearing and impressed at his composure.
You know, I know that Denny's listening tonight, and I know that he, you know, I've told him more than once, and I think that this comes through on that audio. He's his own best advocate in this case.
Absolutely.
Because consistently he has displayed, you know, what you would hope a parent would display in this case.
Paul, something else, you're absolutely right. It's something else that struck me in looking at everything that has gone down and the players that were involved. And honestly, at this point, I think calling them players is pretty apropos. Mm-hmm. There's almost what I, in my mind, the word that pops into my head when I look at the people and how they're interconnected that have led to this debacle and this travesty against this father and these children, there's a real incestuous kind of interaction between all of these people, meaning they're related and they're friends, and there's a lot of interpersonal connections with all of the people that have been involved with this, correct?
Absolutely right.
Yeah, and I, you know what, and I think that you could, because I've seen this in other counties as well, the network is tight in every county. And the same names pop up in every case, you know. They hire the same psychological evaluators. They hire the same guardians ad litem. They hire this, I mean, all of these people, these same things just seem to pop up everywhere you go.
Absolutely right. Here, you know, it's funny that you said good old boy network, because that's certainly a common phrase here. Like I said, I started looking at politics on more of a national and international level, and because of elections in 2012, my focus shifted. And when I started looking at what's going on in my own backyard, as opposed to, you know, I guess everybody thinks that they're informed if you know what's going on in Washington or whatever. But until you actually look at what's going on in your own community, you don't have a real appreciation or understanding for how incestuous this kind of relationship is, incestuous and insidious. And, you know, one of the funny things, we reported also, I know that Dwayne Lester from the Missouri Torch did some reporting on the Maryville case. We did some as well. But one of the things that we found as we were looking at the Lagares case is that you have this same law firm entrenched in that community as well. And we see that, you know, I know that there's certainly an argument or a conversation that can be had around the idea of rape culture or not. But what I do know is this. What I've seen is that this law firm and its influence over our administration in our school districts, it's lockstep with the Common Core directives. And it is absolutely a bully system that needs to be euthanized.
Absolutely. Well, yep. You know, the whole Common Core thing, I mean, it's pretty much a done deal. It's already been implemented. The struggle is to get it out. Eradicating something that's already in is quite a job. Gretchen and Ann have done a great job of getting the information out there. But people, you know, Common Core, like these issues in the courts, you know, eradicating family parental rights, people just don't understand what it is until it affects them. And that's really what's going on here in both of these cases. You know, people think that your schools are taking care of your kids. They've got the best interests of these kids at heart. Same thing with the courts. And really, public education is a public works project. And the judicial system, it's not a justice system, it's a judicial system, and it's an industry. It's a money-making industry. And I think in both of the cases, you have to follow the money. You know, find out what's motivating these issues. It's about following the money. The federal government gives money to states to put kids in foster care, you know, and these industry professionals that work in the legal system work to keep that going. It's job security.
Absolutely right. It's amazing to me that you see going on in education the things that are going on today. I found it very difficult to believe that our education process and our control over it had so quickly and easily been taken from us as citizens and as taxpayers. And I found out quickly in looking at our own school district, one of the things that I want to, and this is kind of a side note, but one of the things I want to make sure that your listeners know, I know it's easy. I have been around, or not that it's not easy. I've been around a lot of children who have learning hurdles and obstacles that are in special education systems. And when we started looking into the Camdenton district itself last year for other reasons, we found a disturbing trend in that department. What we're seeing as we continue to broaden our investigation in looking at special ed and, again, relating it to Common Core, it's really for people who have children that do have learning disabilities, don't be ashamed to talk about bad behavior if you're experiencing it. It's all too easy for us to put our head down and think that somehow that's okay. But this type of thing, particularly in special education, simply shouldn't be the norm. And unfortunately, it seems to be the rule rather than the exception.
Absolutely. Well, Paul Ellison, where can we continue to follow this story? AmericanSpring2011.com. And
absolutely.
And we can listen to you on Guerrilla Radio, American Spring, almost every day of the week. And you're going to keep on top of this. Are you about to release some more information?
We are. We're working right now. The audio tapes that you and I have been that we've been kind of talking about, that's really the centerpiece of the next installment of this investigation. We look at how exactly it is that the school has wedged this crowbar between a father and his kids, and how they have assumed to rewrite those custody agreements. That will be out, it'll be out by Friday of this week.
Okay, great. And one thing I want to punctuate too, because when you're talking about family court issues, people don't want to deal with it because they just think it's so messy and stuff. This is not about separating fathers from children. Because I can tell you there are just as many, if not more, mothers that are being separated from their children under these kinds of circumstances. This is about chopping away at the very foundation of our culture. It's about eliminating the family structure. And you have to vilify one to be able to go after the other or to give the other. And when you do that, you completely eradicate the family structure in this country. And the courts have been doing this for decades upon decades. So when people come to you with an issue like this and they tell you there's a story here and they look at you and say, oh, you know, it's a divorce, don't want to deal with it. You know, it's, you know, divorces are a mess. Well, maybe it's not such a mess because maybe the court system has escalated the issue beyond anything that it ever needed to be. And, you know, they're telling you, and if they can divide you, they can conquer you. If they can get the men fighting the women and the women fighting the men, it's not about putting families together or doing the right thing for kids. It suddenly becomes an issue where men are, you know, it's men against women, and that's how they divide you. And this is not that. This is not about men, you know, men are better for their children or women are better for their children. This is about people parenting their kids, fathers parenting their kids and mothers parenting their kids and maintaining some sense of family.
Ultimately, too, Lisa, one point that I think stood out to me when you were talking is that this also helps to further empower the state and these bureaucracies to do the wrong thing and to take these children away and to take control
right.
of them.
Right.
And that is a huge problem. And that's what's happened here. It's what's happening with the Pelletier case. It's what's being repeated all across the country. And people need to get involved. And I'm sorry, I think, Paul, you were going to say something?
Yeah, just quickly. I was going to say that I couldn't agree more, that it isn't really an issue of sex or father, mother. It really isn't about that in any way. It's about simply a parent's rights. And, you know, what we've seen here is the worst case scenario of all the different controversial pieces of legislation or programs, whether it be Obamacare or Common Core. This is the end result if we don't take action as communities to stand up against this kind of behavior.
Absolutely. Okay, you can follow this story at AmericanSpring2011.com and follow Paul Ellison on Guerrilla Radio, American Spring. Thank you so much, Paul, for coming on and talking about this issue. It is so important.
Thank you, ladies. Have a great night.
Thanks. We're going to take a break, and we'll be right back with Duane Weed.
And so, my fellow Americans, ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
You better not cry. You better not pout. I'm telling you why. Santa Claus is coming.
No matter what time of year it is, it's never too early to start preparing for the holidays. And here at Missouri Grassroots Coalition, we're thinking of Christmas now. Why? Because we've set an ambitious goal for ourselves to raise $2,000. That's right, we want to raise $2,000 in 2013 to help some Missouri families who may be struggling in this Obama economy to provide a magical Christmas morning for their children. Last year, in 2012, Missouri Grassroots Coalition touched the lives of 15 families because of the generosity of conservatives across the state who provided us with the means to pay off their layaway accounts on Christmas Eve. This year, we'd like to be able to help twice that number of families, and we're asking you to help us with that goal. Please go to MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org and click on the Secret Santa tab. All the details are there for you to send us what you can by PayPal, check, or money order. We want to thank all who contributed last year for their generosity and hope that you will all help us continue to prove that charitable giving works best in a constitutional republic.
And the government of the people, by the people, for the people, shall not perish from the earth.
This is Missouri Grassroots Radio, and you are listening to Culture Vigilante. I'm here with Cindy McGee. I want to thank Paul Ellison for coming on earlier and talking about this incredible story that's happening right here in Missouri. It kind of mirrors all the things in the headlines right now with the Justina Pelletier case and the other things that are going on as far as parental rights. I mean, we've had the folks from parentalrights.org on to talk about the parental rights issues that they're fighting on a national level. It's a huge issue. And it's like I said before, I think that the situation is that if they can chip away at the cornerstone of what makes this country great, and that's the American family, they can get you. And one of the ways that they're doing it is fighting, you know, turning us against ourselves. It's just not a good thing. It's serious. And there are a lot more people out there that have been suffering with these kinds of things for a very long time. But I want to move on. Last week, we were going to have an interview with Duane Weed regarding the Oath Keepers and the plan that they have put together to inform and engage folks and get them moving actually actively in their communities to kind of bring things together so that we can kind of fight all of these issues that are going on across the country. A couple of weeks ago, InfoWars, Alex Jones, published an article, Oath Keepers is going operational by forming special civilization preservation teams. And I had a great conversation with Duane Weed a couple of weeks back about this article and what Oath Keepers is doing in Missouri and actually across the country to organize people inform them and help them kind of be their own best advocate for personal responsibility. So let's take a listen to that interview right now.
This is Lisa Payne Nager, and you're listening to Culture Vigilante on Missouri Grassroots Radio, and we are very happy to have with us again Dr. Duane Weed. Dr. Weed is here tonight to talk to us about some different aspects of things that he's been talking about before with us. He's a great survivalist. He's got a fabulous website, The New Survivalist, and he's been on with us to talk about that those issues before, but now he's with us tonight to talk about Oath Keepers, and the mission that they have set forth for themselves to prepare folks for what they think is coming in the future, and to talk about maybe some of the financial things that he wants to warn us about with the looming financial crisis that everybody's talking about. So thanks for being with me today, Dr. Weed.
Well, thank you for having me, Lisa.
Okay, so we have a lot to cover. There's just a lot of issues going on here. You, I contacted you a couple of weeks ago about coming back on the show and kind of talking about some of the issues that we've talked about in the past. You forwarded me an article from InfoWars about Oath Keepers and going operational, forming special civilization preparation preservation teams. First of all, let's talk about what Oath Keepers is, because I'm a little bit familiar with it, but not a lot familiar with it. What is Oath Keepers?
Okay, Oath Keepers is a national organization. It was founded by Stuart Rhodes, who is a veteran, who is airborne. And Oath Keepers, Stuart is now a constitutional lawyer, and he also worked in Washington, D.C., for Ron Paul. He was working on Ron Paul's staff at one point in Washington, D.C., but he has a lot of experience both as a veteran and also as a constitutional lawyer, of course. But really, Oath Keepers was founded by Stuart and some of his veteran and police friends, I think largely as a response to what happened in New Orleans after Hurricane Katrina. And if people are not aware of the story there, as it turned out, in the aftermath of Hurricane Katrina, the mayor of New Orleans came out on the news media, and a lot of people have seen this video. It's on, posted on YouTube, the famous video. He says, no one's going to be allowed to have any guns. And what happened was... they actually sent, I'm not sure if it was police or National Guard, or but there are military guys. I think it was a lot. I think a lot of it was the police.
Right.
I think the National Guard was involved too. They actually sent people into the neighborhoods. These were neighborhoods that weren't actually destroyed by the hurricane, but went more into middle class neighborhoods, and they went door to door and did gun confiscation. And
there's very
I think it was kind of a testing ground. You know,
yeah.
I think they were using the disaster as kind of a testing ground to see if they could get, you know, their people to confiscate guns and to see what the American reaction would be.
Well, there was very little coverage of that aspect of the situation. That, you know, the mainstream media that I can recall did not really cover the fact that they were going door-to-door confiscating law-abiding citizens' guns.
Right, exactly. No, you won't see things like this in the mainstream media pretty much. They're pretty well controlled, pro-government, you know, always portraying the government in a positive light. But there is a lot of – it was covered by the local media down there, the local television stations, and they got a lot of footage of it. And so a lot of the local news broadcasts have been archived on YouTube. And if you go on YouTube and do a search for gun confiscation after Katrina, something like that, you'll come up with all kinds of videos showing these guys going door-to-door, banging on the doors, going in their houses. There's one video in particular that went viral because there was this little old lady in there, and they came in and they said, you know, you're going to have to go with us. And she said, and her home wasn't damaged at all. And she said, no, I'm fine right here. and they all came in her house, and she was in the kitchen there, and she pointed to her food stock, and she said, "You can see I'm prepared here. I've got plenty of food and everything." And then she opened up her hand and had her little revolver in her hand, not pointing it at anyone, but just in her open palm, just showing them her revolver, saying, "And you see, I'm protected here. I can take care of myself." And as soon as they saw the revolver, not pointed at anyone, not threatening or anything like that, they just tackled this lady, took her down, and injured her, you know, because she's a little fragile little lady. And anyway, they got that. There was a news crew there, and they got all of that on videotape. But that's a very interesting video.
My God,
to watch.
We had a great show last week about the militarization of the police, and that's just another example of it. And it's been going on for a lot longer than most people know.
All right, exactly. But anyway, I think they were using Katrina, the way they handled this. I think they were using it as kind of a testing ground to see what, you know, see what their troops would do, see if they would follow these orders, and to see how the people would react. But anyway, as a reaction to that, of course, all of these guys who had done these gun confiscations, these are all people who had taken an oath to the Constitution. And I'm sure most people are aware that anybody who joins the American military or the police or the fire department and various other services like that, they all take an oath, and the oath that they take is not to the mayor, it's not to the president, it is not to their commanding officer. The oath that they take is to the Constitution of the United States. And, of course, the Constitution of the United States, in the Bill of Rights, you know, it allows us to, it doesn't allow us. I mean, our rights, actually, according to the Constitution and our founding fathers, our rights come, our natural rights, which means they come from God. But what the Constitution and Bill of Rights does is it just enumerates these rights just to make sure that the government is aware of them, you know, and so the Bill of Rights and Constitution doesn't give us our rights. It actually affirms our rights just to make sure the government knows that these are our rights. But anyway, the point is, all of these people who did this gun confiscation, they were violating their oath. You know, they take an oath to the Constitution before God. And so a lot of people like Stuart Rhodes, other people in the military who are liberty-minded, Constitution-minded, you know, they were just appalled at this situation. And they said, look, you know, we need to make sure that this kind of thing doesn't happen. We need to educate our people, educate other people in the military, our police officers, and remind them of their oath. And in situations like this, you know, their oath is, like I said, not to the mayor, you know, who comes out and says no one's going to be allowed to own guns, but their oath is actually to the Constitution. And, of course, Stuart Rhodes, being a constitutional lawyer, is well aware of the legalities of this, and that is, in those cases, the duty of those police and military is to obey, is to disobey. Their duty is not to obey an order if it is illegal. Their duty is to disobey any order that is unconstitutional. You know, so these guys should have remembered their oath, and they should have said, well, wait a minute, no, we're not going to do that. And actually, it turns out that some of the people down in New Orleans, I think some of the National Guard or some of the military, I'm not sure exactly what role they had or what, you know, what branch they were in. But, I mean, some of them actually did refuse to do that. Some of them said, you know, look, this is not right. And they said that to his commanding officer, and the commanding officer said, yeah, you know what, you're right, we're not going to do this. So it actually, that was another thing that was not big in the news. But there were some people who did stand down. But unfortunately, there were far too many who did follow the unconstitutional orders.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, so Stuart Rhodes and some other veterans and peace officers founded Oath Keepers. I think it was right about 2004, if I remember correctly, which would be about 10 years ago. They started Oath Keepers as an organization for military, police, veterans, first responders, you know, fire department, firemen, anyone who's taken an oath to the Constitution, but they also opened up their membership to the general public, and they have what's called associate members, which means that if you did not serve in the military, if you're not a veteran or police officer or whatever, but you're just a concerned citizen, you can still join Oath Keepers. And as it turned out, especially here in our local St. Louis and St. Charles chapter, most of our members are actually associate members, which is what I am myself. I'm not a veteran. I'm just, you know, a concerned citizen. But, you know, concerned citizens who want to recruit peace officers and veterans and military personnel into the organization, so, you know, so that we can so that we can educate them, so that when eventually, if they are ever faced with a choice like the people in New Orleans were faced with, you know, hopefully rather than just responding automatically like they're trained to do, just responding automatically to orders, you know, hopefully they will think about this, and more of them will stand up and you know, refuse to follow the unconstitutional orders.
Okay, Duane, okay, so this leads me to, I have a lot of questions swimming around in my head, and I'll try to be brief, but when a police officer or any law enforcement official takes their oath to, you know, to hold that position, don't they already swear to uphold the Constitution? Where does the disconnect happen?
Where does what happen?
Where does the disconnect happen?
Oh, where does the disconnect happen? Well, you know, I can tell you, they just don't think about it. You know, they when they first sign it. Well, I can kind of illustrate what happened with a young fella here that I know personally, someone in my family here, who he joined the military and he went off to boot camp, and then when he came back to St. Louis after being out of state for a while in boot camp, came back all, you know, all in his nice uniform and everything, and I talked to him a little bit because I, you know, I was aware of the oath that they all had to take, and I asked him, I said, you know, do you remember taking an oath when you were down there at boot camp? And he said, yeah. And I said, well, do you remember who you swore allegiance to? And he thought for a minute, and he couldn't tell me. And he just kind of made a guess, and he said, the president? And, of course, you know, not to blame him, because he, you know, he's a 18, 19-year-old kid, and, you know, just right out of high school practically, doesn't, you know, not wise in the ways of the world like us older guys have become. And a lot of things were going on, of course, in boot camp. They were just being hit with a lot of information and other things from all directions. And so I don't blame him for not remembering this. But I said, no, I said, your oath was not to the president. Your oath was to the Constitution of the United States. And he said, oh, yeah, that's right. All right, so I think what happens is they take the oath, and then they just kind of forget about it. You know, then they get, as far as a peace officer is concerned, he takes the oath, you know, way back when he goes into police academy or comes out of police academy, I'm not sure when, but, and then he goes out in the streets. Well, then he has, you know, all this day-to-day training from his department, and then also, of course, the feds come in and, you know, do a lot of training for them. FEMA comes in and does some training for them. Department of Homeland Security comes in and does training for them. And when they do, they never remind them of that oath that they took back when they first signed up, you know. So I think it's something they just forget, and they just get, you know, tied, boggles down with their day-to-day activities, and they're just kind of trained and to just follow orders, they just don't think, you know, just don't think it through. And that's really the purpose of Oath Keepers, is to remind them so that they will, you know, think it through.
Okay. All right, so now that we have established the meaning of the Oath Keepers' mission, what is this latest development regarding this article from InfoWars that you sent me? It seems like you guys are, first of all, Oath Keepers is a national organization. You have chapters all over the country, and there is a website, and we'll get to that later on in the interview. But now, as the organization has grown over the years, there is
there's a mission for you guys to kind of organize and reach out a little farther.
Right, right. Well, this is, I've heard it worded, as a matter of fact, I think Stuart Rhodes, our founder, worded it this way. He said, Oathkeepers goes operational. And what this is this is sort of a response to what's happening to our country today. As we're, fast approaching a critical type of disastrous type of situation. And what I mean by disasters, you know, you have all kinds of disasters. You can have, like in Katrina, you could have a hurricane. You also have man-made disasters, you know, like war, invasion of a foreign enemy, or a government coup or something like that. So there are all kinds of disasters that you can have, and they're not all natural disasters. But Stuart Rhodes and a lot of other people, too, are seeing a disaster right around the corner of a man-made type disaster in the form of a financial collapse. And this is something that's been going on for years. It's something that's been predicted, you know, years ago. Ron Paul has talked about it a lot. Other people have too. A lot of the prognosticators, Gerald Flinty, Trends Research Journal. You know, people whose business it is to kind of forecast, you know, what's coming down the line. But with our financial situation, basically, as Ron Paul has said, is, you know, we're beyond the point of no return. You know, the dollar is going to collapse. We're going to have a currency collapse, and our entire economic system is going to be turned upside down, and who knows what kind of situation that could lead to, but it's not good. You know, in other words, it could be, a disruption in supply chains, you know, as far as, like, food getting out there. You know, in other words, food not getting to your grocery store shelves. You know, we're depending on food that is shipped in from faraway places. A lot of the food we get here in Missouri comes from California. So what we're basically talking about is some type of disruption, which could lead to food shortages. And as we've seen just recently with this cold weather down there in And this is a situation that we see occur over and over and over again. Down there in Georgia, people preparing for the cold, running out and buying everything off the grocery store shelf, and the shelves ended up empty. And then people got nasty with each other and started fighting over things and stuff like that. And that was just, 3 inches of snow?
Right, exactly. People are not prepared for any kind of looming disaster, and I would agree with you. I mean, everybody's talking about the looming financial crisis that's about to hit, and the inflation that's about to come, and you know, they're expecting everybody to lose all of their savings and then their investments, right. And it's not pretty.
Right? No, it's not. Stuart Rhodes has, when he says Oathkeepers is going operational, basically what he's talking about is he's talking about preparing for a disaster. In other words, Oathkeepers are, as you know, our chapters. Oathkeepers is a nationwide organization. We do have chapters we're having chapters that are starting locally, and these are like people who had signed up with Oathkeepers at the national organization, but then start meeting up with other Oathkeepers, you know, in their community, so he's this civilization preservation program that he's talking about. As far as you think about the wording civilization preservation, if you think about a situation where there's like in a worst case scenario, you have a collapse of society and an interruption of services, and who knows how bad, you know, how bad it could get. There could be rioting and crimes, you know,
sure,
which could totally overwhelm the police and And again, this is one of the situations as Oath Keepers that we're, you know, that we're preparing for as far as, you know, if martial law is implemented, which martial law in and of itself is illegal. There's nothing in the Constitution that allows for martial law. So martial law in and of itself in this country is unconstitutional and is illegal. A lot of people don't realize that. But as Ron Paul so aptly said a few years back, he says, you know, it's not during good times that we really need our rights. He says, it's in bad times, you know, that our rights are most important. In other words, our Bill of Rights, you know, our Bill of Rights was written or they evolved at a time period after the Revolution or during and after the Revolutionary War. And if you look at all 10 of the Bill of Rights, they were things that the British government had implemented among the American colonies. And it was martial law. You know, what the British had declared was the British had declared that Americans were not going to be governing themselves anymore. Instead, you know, General Thomas Gage, British general in Boston, Massachusetts, he became the governor of Massachusetts. And in effect, what they did at that time, and they wouldn't allow the colonists to govern themselves, is they actually put the colonists under martial law. And they were doing all these things like warrantless searches of the American people, detaining American citizens without due cause or without warrants. Anyway, if you look down the list of the 10 Bill of Rights, the British government, even housing soldiers in American homes,
right.
The British government was violating every one of these 10 Bill of Rights, and it was a state of martial law, and that was the reason for our Declaration of Independence, and that was the reason for our Revolutionary War, and that was the reason for our Bill of Rights. So, like Ron Paul said, it's not during the good times that we need our Bill of Rights. It is in times like these, you know, in other words, in times when the government would declare martial law. You know, that's mm-hmm. not an excuse to take away our Bill of Rights. That's the time that we need them the most.
So in this statement where Oath Keepers is going operational, is this a plan to steer the government back on track? Is it a plan to help the people navigate through martial law? What is it exactly?
Well, no, it's not a plan to steer the government back on track. It's a plan to help people deal with it, to help people to get through. And like the name says, civilization preservation is to preserve civilization. It's to preserve some type of order in locally, you know, in your own community there. You know, it's strictly local. But some of the areas that we teach, like I said, this is all, you know, your basic prepper, disaster preparedness type stuff. Is one of the categories is communications. One thing that we're involved with, that we're getting involved with right now, is ham radios. All the Oath Keepers in our area now, we're all getting little ham radios. You can get these little handheld ham radios for $30. It's not something that's really expensive to get into. You can take a class. We're getting licensed, you know, so that we can go ahead and start communicating. And I have people tell me, well, you know what, during an emergency, you don't have to have a license. And I said, yes, that's right, but we're not in an emergency right now, and we need to learn how to use our radios, and you have to have a license to get on there and learn how to use radios. But anyway, so when the grid goes down, think about if there's a loss of electricity, say from an EMP attack, you know, say, which knocks out our electricity, and we don't have internet anymore, we don't have telephone service, the cell phone towers, which require electricity are down, your cell phone isn't working, you know, how are we going to communicate? Well, ham radios, battery-operated ham radios, you know, operating radio to radios, a way that we can, you know, stay in contact with other people in our group. And we're learning a first aid, you know, just your basic disaster stuff, how to take care of someone who's injured, who especially if you can't immediately get them because during riots and things like that, all of the emergency responders are going to be busy, and it may be hours or days before they can get to you, you know. So if you have someone who gets injured, it might not be just a matter of calling 911 and having an ambulance show up in 5 or 10 minutes, you know. In other words, we're trying to learn to be able to take care of the person, you know, until we can get, you know, professional help. Other things like scouting, we're getting into land navigation, compass reading, search and rescue, wilderness survival, bush skills. These are just, you know, your basic prepper things. Learn, you know, just basically what we're talking about is just learning to do things on your own and not relying on government services to do anything for you. In preparing for a time when those government services, you know, may be interrupted, and you're left on your own, you know. And I think that if we ever reach a situation like that, I think your greatest asset is going to be your network, or in other words, you know, the people around you. You know, your neighbors are going to be your greatest asset. Your network. Like with Oath Keepers, you know, our fellow Oath Keeper members, you know, people that we've been working and training with all along, you know, other people who've been preparing, putting aside food storage and things like that, you know, people who have prepared and are not going to be, you know, just out there totally helpless, you know, looking for a disaster. Disaster relief. You know, the last thing we want to do is to do what a lot of people in New Orleans were reduced to after the hurricane, and that is depending on a government-run shelter. You know, and we saw the horror stories that took place, you know, in the New Orleans Astrodome.
Yeah.
The shelters down there. We don't want to end up in a shelter. You know, we don't want to be so hungry to where we're having to go to a government shelter to get food. You know, in other words, we want to be prepared to be able to take care of ourselves.
So this is a fabulous program. So basically, the prepper mentality is kind of reaching out into the public, into the community, to try to grow the prepper mentality to relieve the dependence on government during a disaster, during an unfortunate situation. Don't want to go as far as, you know, martial law, but it could be. You just don't know. And trying to educate the folks and help them build their networks in their community. That's a great idea. It's fabulous. How successful are you guys? I know you and I live in the same community, Duane, but how successful is this program going across the country? Do you know?
It varies from place to place. I mean, you know, in a lot of places there's nothing going on at all, and then in some places people are quite organized. You know, there are some rural communities where a lot of like-minded people are getting together, and they have a very good, you know, very good network where everybody around them, you know, is on the same page, and everybody has their food storage and, you know, you don't have to worry when a disaster strikes. You don't have to worry about people who haven't prepared, you know, coming and knocking on your door, you know, and wanting your food. But unfortunately, in far, far, far too many places, you know, people are just not prepared at all. And again, we're reminded of this anytime something happens, you know, like recently with the cold weather and the ice storms and the snow, you know, we're, you know, something really minor and insignificant that people should be able to deal with, like 3 inches of snow, you know, causing the grocery store shelves to be bare, and then people.
Yeah, the city's practically shut down.
Like crazy.
Yeah, so correct me if I'm wrong. I'm going to go down a road here. Maybe it's way off base. But are you finding maybe that there's more acceptance of this kind of attitude about prepping and community outreach and community preservation in the rural areas rather than in the urban areas?
Oh, yes, yes, certainly. And, well, first of all, you know, people in the rural areas are, I mean, They're already largely self-sufficient. To a large extent, not completely, but they're compared to the people in the city. I know a lot of people in rural Missouri. Have a lot of friends who live in rural Missouri, and you know, I've got everybody that I can think of has chickens. You know, and they raise their own eggs. They raise most of their own meat. Most of them have cows. Produce their own milk. Some of them have goats, but they all hunt. You know, they all have firearms. They're all ready to go. I mean, and not only ready, but on a regular basis. You know, they go out. I mean, I know a lot of people who their primary source of meat is hunting. All right, and then of course they have. I mean, being out in the area like that, you have to be self-sufficient to a certain extent. You know, you might not even have water, municipal water supplied to you. You might have your own well.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly, just because of their lifestyle, people in rural Missouri are far, far, far greater than people. And I live, you know, pretty close to the city. I live in a suburb here. Yeah, I live on the east side of 270. The people I see around me, at best case scenario is they've got 3 days of food in their house, and that would reduce them down to, you know, eating peanut butter.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Right. So I mean, with the impending financial doom that everybody's predicting, you know, you can always hope that it doesn't happen, but. You know, if history repeats itself, it's absolutely going to happen, and we're all going to be in big trouble. Do you have any advice for folks, or is there any preparation in this plan for financial safety, or is there a financial safety net, or is that a topic for another show?
Yeah, well, that's, you know, any topic that you take in this field. I mean, you could take any topic and make a whole show out of it. You know, we could make a whole show just out of water, you know, getting clean water or food preservation or whatever. As far as financial, what people have to do is as far as the timeline, I have no idea what the timeline is. There's so many factors that can play in. There's so many things that they can do to delay it, you know, for another month and another month and another month. All I know is everyone who I've been listening to, like Gerald Salenti, Trends Research Journal. I've been listening to Gerald for over 10 years, and Gerald he puts out a journal, Trends Research Journal, and he's been on the news quite often. I've been listening to Gerald for a long time, and Gerald has been right on the money as far as making his predictions and everything. But people like Gerald Salenti, you can definitely tell there's much more urgency in their predictions, you know, as far as the collapse is concerned, the financial collapse. You can see a lot more urgency to where it's feeling like, you know, 2014. Personally, my own personal idea is based on talking to some of these other people. It's 2014, 2015. It's probably going to be very, very, very significant years. You know, some of the things that we've been seeing coming for like the last 10 or 20 years are probably going to hit here toward the latter half of 2014 or 2015.
Wow.
So, I hate to put a date down there. You know, I hate to put a date because then as soon as you don't hit that date, you know, then of course you're wrong, and then from then on you're wrong. But I'm just telling what my own personal feeling on the matter is, and everybody is feeling increased urgency. As far as what you can do, what you can think about is you can think about your dollars becoming less and less worthless. Like right now, the dollar that we have right now is worth a nickel compared to the dollars we had back in the 70s.
Wow.
And that dollar wasn't worth nearly as much as what it was back in 1913 when they founded the Federal Reserve. So we're definitely what's going to happen when the dollar collapses, and the dollar is collapsing. It's not like the dollar is going to collapse. The dollar is collapsing right now. I mean, the disaster that we see coming is occurring right now, and it's been going on for a while. It's just kind of in slow motion. You know, it's the dollar's collapsing in slow motion. And just one example is that the fact that a $1970 worth of nickel today. I mean,
right.
that's a collapse of the currency right there. But, of course, as it gets toward the end, though, it accelerates exponentially. And at some point, you know, we could end up with a Zimbabwe dollar where the dollar, you know, it takes $1 billion. And literally in Zimbabwe, that's what happened. It took $1 billion just to buy a loaf of bread. So protect yourself. Just, you know, stay out of paper dollars and buy real assets like gold and silver. You know, right now gold and silver prices are low, and people look at that and they say, well, you know, that silver hasn't been a good investment. Look how low it is right now. But still, even though silver's low right now, it's still $20 an ounce, whereas, you know, 10 years ago it was more like $5.
Right.
All right. Well, so just look over the last 10 years. From five, even though it went up to 50, and now it's going back down to 20, it's still $20 now compared to $5 an ounce. And during that same time period, what has the dollar done? You know, the dollar's lost. Just in that time period, dollar's lost half its value. And the way that we see the dollar losing its value is in the prices of things. You know, I mean, the dollar, when you open your wallet, it still looks like it's the same size and everything. But, you know, you take that dollar to the grocery store, and you know, when you buy something in the grocery store, that dollar buys half as much as what it would buy, you know, just 10 years ago.
And in the event of a financial collapse, it would be good. It's a good form of currency for trade and barter.
Right. Yeah. But it's a good way to protect the value of your wealth. You know, because as your dollars are slipping away into nothing, your gold and silver is still maintaining its value. And there's an inverse relationship. But we know the dollar is falling. And we know there's always, throughout history of the world, there's always an inverse relationship between gold and silver and the dollar.
Mm-hmm.
All right, so we know as the dollar goes down, gold and silver is going to go up. And we've seen that over the last years, you know. It has, despite their attempts to manipulate it, and I still think the price is way low right now because of manipulation. All right, but the good news is that means that right now it's a good deal to buy gold and silver.
Mm-hmm.
Because they've manipulated the price lower than what it should be. It's a bargain.
Okay.
Right now.
All right.
So that's one way to protect yourself, protect your money.
I would love to have you come. We've talked about this before, and I think it's just a matter of we need to schedule around our schedules. But I would love to have you come back and discuss these issues because all of this is crucial. You know, 10 years ago we would have never thought we would be sitting in this situation where we would be watching the collapse of our government and the bastardization of our Constitution and the peril, you know, facing the peril of our economic situation the way we are. I would love to have you come back and talk on these topics very soon if you're available. I'm going to kind of chase you down and pull you back in. Okay, so I want to give people an opportunity to get informed and involved. How can folks get involved in Oath Keepers? I'm assuming you're looking to reach out to folks to grow this number.
Right. Well, great. We just started the St. Louis chapter just within a year. It's only been about 8 or 10 months ago, and we've grown quite a bit. Every meeting that we meet twice a month, and every meeting that we have new people who come. But we meet the second Wednesday and fourth Tuesday of every month at 7 o'clock p.m. And this is a St. Charles, St. Louis Oath Keepers. And eventually, as our numbers grow, we're going to split off, and St. Charles is going to have their own group, which will meet on the other side of the Missouri River. Right now we're meeting together because we're such a new organization as far as our chapter is concerned. But we meet the second Wednesday and fourth Tuesday of every month, 7 o'clock p.m. at House Bible Will Travel Church on 1745 Craig Road, and we're not affiliated with the church. I need to say that, but the church is just kind enough to allow us to use one of their meeting rooms. An important thing to remember is that you do not have to be a military veteran or peace officer to join Oath Keepers, and the vast majority of our members are associate members like myself. I'm the president of our St. Louis St. Charles chapter, and I'm an associate member. So associate members have the same standing as veterans, military, because a lot of people think that you have to be a peace officer or to be oathkeeper, and that is not true at all. But anyway, and we have a website now. It's a new website. What I'm doing basically is each meeting we have a presentation. We have a guest that comes in. At our last meeting this past week, we had a major who came in who is he's the founder of the Eastern Missouri Militia, and he came in and talked to us. But we had someone who came in and talked to us about food preservation, someone who came in and talked to us about making your own colloidal silver for your natural antibiotics. So we're having we cover a topic each meeting, and I'm recording those on my video camera and posting those on our website to archive them. And that website, that's our local website, is stlouisoathkeepers.info, and that's St. Louis, S-T-L-O-U-I-S, with no punctuation, stlouisoathkeepers.info. And the national organization for oathkeepers, if you're outside this area, is oathkeepers.org.
Okay. And you have a great website also. If you're at all interested in survivalist and prepper techniques, Dr. Dwayne Weed has a website like none other I've seen out there with just all of the best information on every possible question you could have about prepping. Is the newsurvivalist.com. And we're going to have him back as soon as I can pull him in to talk about some of the issues that he's got posted on his website. Dr. Weed, thank you so much for this. I also want to stress, too, that I don't know very much about Oathkeepers, but I do know that you guys are very community-based. I know that you go out into the community and do good deeds all the time. You guys have been organized for a while doing that. I've run into a few of the Oathkeepers around town. It's a great organization to look into. I hope you all will at least go to the website and check it out and go to thenewsurvivalist.com. And Dr. Weed, thank you so much for being on with me today.
Thank you, Lisa. My pleasure.
Okay, we'll talk to you again soon.
Okay, thank you.
Missouri Grassroots Radio is brought to you by the Missouri Grassroots Coalition, a cooperative of independent Missouri groups whose aim is to restore constitutional government. Visit us at MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org, check out our Facebook page, and follow us on Twitter. You can contact us anytime at info@MissouriGrassrootsCoalition.org. God bless and keep you till next time we meet.